Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 150. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around to celebrate the 150, I'm looking at 2014, the movies I've seen, the movies I recommend, the movies I don't recommend, and everything in between. So this is a little bit of a capsule episode, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show, and I will get those contact details out of the way in just a moment or two. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Okay, how is everybody? It's December, which, of course, to an Australian or anybody else from the Southern Hemisphere, means that the weather's warming up, we have barbecues, people who are attractive wear less clothing than normal, and the living is easy. Northern Hemisphere, not so much, but it's your fault for living there. So I'm looking out the window and there's not a cloud in the sky. It's really the time of year that I like the most. Not because Santa's going to come and Newton Mass is on its way and all that kind of thing, but mostly because the weather's comfortable for me. I like warm weather. I'm a warm weather kind of person, even though I do live in a temperate climate. And I enjoy the summertime most of all. So what's been happening? Sal's been in hospital for a while. She's actually out for a few hours and sitting in the lounge room as I speak. She's a podcast widow even when she's in hospital. She should be out for good around the 19th, and hopefully everything will go fine after that. But in the meantime, it's been a little bit strange being around the house by myself and then spending an hour or so visiting her. It's nowhere near as hard as it's been for certain other people, but you know, it's something I'm not used to, and it's a kind of headspace and an environment that I'm not used to visiting. So, and it's all part of life's interesting tapestry of events and environments. So we're doing okay, and everything should be fine. I'm not taking any time off while Christmas Newton misses on, because I took a week off at the beginning of the month just as Sal went in, so I could kind of depressurize and get used to her being in hospital, and watched a few movies, had a little bit of a good time, visited a couple of people, and just kind of chilled out and took care of business the way I needed to. So what have I been watching? Now, I know this particular podcast is going to be about what I've been watching over the year, but I probably should keep to the usual format and just look at the stuff I've been watching lately. There have been a few things. Some of them interesting, some of them not so much. I'll just go to the letterboxed page and work it all out. Got a recommendation for you. Now, I'm probably going to do this in these two films in a future podcast, because they're both made by Australians and they're both really interesting genre works. The first one's called These Final Hours, which is a bit unlike any other film that I've seen. It's set in Perth, Western Australia, one of my favourite places around the town, well, around the country at least. And the setup is this. Basically, around the other side of the Earth, in the North Atlantic, asteroid has hit the Earth. And Perth is one of the very last places that's going to be swept up in the firestorm as all life on Earth gets fucked. So it's a story of a kind of 20-something guy whose life really is a shambles. He's in love with one woman. He's got a girlfriend elsewhere. And he's got to kind of come to terms with his own mortality and with his personal life while all of this, basically the world's going to hell. There's all social cohesion's broken down. Some people are partying. Some people are giving into their darkest desires. It's really an anarchic kind of situation. A lot of people have committed suicide around the place. And this young guy has to kind of come to terms with his last hours on Earth. And to complicate it all, he sees two men dragging a young girl into a house. And almost reluctantly, he goes in and rescues her, and she's about 10 or 11. And he kind of gets coerced into promising her that he will help her find her parents, her father. And they end up on this kind of one-day road trip to find the young girl's father and for him to kind of come to terms with his own life, in a sense. It's a bit hard to describe, but it's a really excellent film. Not a big budget, but Jesus, a nice bit of genre work. You really should check out These Final Hours. Really, a movie that it's on my list. Anyway, I did see a few other things. I did see Stretch, the movie with Patrick Wilson, directed by Joe Carnahan. Nice little kind of lowish budget action flick about a limo driver in Hollywood and the events of one night in his life. It's not a bad little watch. It's nothing spectacular. It's not Rules of the Game or anything like that, but definitely worth checking out. I did watch Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace again. I've already seen Skyfall fairly recently because, of course, we have the announcement of the name and the cast of the new James Bond film, Spectre. So I thought I'd revisit the Daniel Craig Bonds, and I kind of enjoyed doing that. It was worth doing. I did see a nice little comedy about voiceover artists called Inner World, directed and starring Lake Bell. And, yeah, that was kind of fun, too. I'd heard a little bit about it, and it's one of those kind of light, lowish budget comedies where a bunch of voiceover artists and comedians and that get together and put on a show, in a sense. So you might want to check that one out. I did go to the Hardtop Cinema and saw Exodus, Gods and Kings, Ridley Scott's latest little effort. Now, the more I see of Ridley Scott's work, the less I'll think of him. It's a really fucked up bit of story about Moses and the Exodus out of Egypt and the plagues of Egypt and all that kind of stuff. There are a few moments of amusement. The CGI is pretty good. I think the script is less so. And the interesting thing is seeing Joel Edgerton playing the Pharaoh, because what Joel Edgerton does playing the Pharaoh, which I find incredibly funny, is he's kind of channeling Jack Hawkins in Valley of the Kings from the 1950s. There's a bit of Jack Hawkins there. There's a little bit of a few other British actors of the time, people like Anthony Quayle, for instance, and Richard Burton. He's kind of doing a 1950s British stage-trained movie star voice. And if you see Exodus, Gods and Kings, check that out, because that's really pretty much what he's doing. And, yeah, it's the only thing that kept me amused for a large chunk of that film. So I've seen a few other things. Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, the Hammer horror film from the early 1970s, starring Horst Janssen and Carolyn Munro, for instance. And, yeah, that one's fun. I picked it up cheaply. I've got it like a dual DVD Blu-ray box of it, and it was one of the few that had been released. They released them about a year ago here in Australia, and Shock Video released them. They released a whole bunch of Hammer stuff, and this was the one that I hadn't had yet, so I found a copy of it and picked it up. And yeah, it's a solid piece. Some people say it's the last good movie that Hammer did in the 1970s, but that's a bit debatable. But it's definitely worth checking out. I did also pick up on a Liam Neeson action film from not too long ago called Nonstop, where he's playing an alcoholic airplane marshal. And hang on, my mouse is doing some weird things here. Give me a sec. That was weird. My wireless mouse started wandering all over the screen, the mouse cursor, and it's just done it again. Not sure what's going on there. Maybe I need to replace a battery on this fucker. But anyway, back to Liam Neeson. He's an air marshal, and somebody's threatening to kill people on the plane unless he delivers millions of dollars. He gets them to give them millions of dollars electronically. Julianne Moore's in it and a bunch of other people. It's a kind of Liam Neeson action film, and Liam Neeson always strikes me as a really odd choice for an action star, because he's always looking kind of sad and he doesn't radiate charisma the way that we're used to action stars doing, people from the 1980s, your Bruce Willis's, your Arnie's, your Sly Stallone's. He doesn't have any of that kind of thing. He's just, this big Irish lunk with a broken nose who kills things. So that one was a little bit odd to see. Let me find what else I'll be watching. I did see, I didn't mention the second one of the Australian films that I was, that I'm impressed with and really want to talk about, and that is Predestination by the Sperry Brothers, starring Ethan Hawke. And that one's interesting because it's an adaptation of Robert Heinlein's story, All You Zombies, which, if you've read the story, leads you into interesting directions. All I will say about it is I like the Sperry Brothers stuff. I think they're audacious, and they try to bite off more than they can chew a lot of the time with the movies that they do. And it's one of the few movies where basically most of the characters are the same person. I'm not going to say anything more than that. But, Predestination, you should check that out. I did see something from the 1970s, A Guilty Pleasure, even though, as we know, I don't get guilty about having pleasure. And that is a movie starring Candice Rialson called Chatterbox, which is an adaptation of a French Alpha France hardcore porn movie. It's a softcore American adaptation of a hardcore French movie from Alpha France, who were the studio in the 1970s that did a lot of high-end adult films in France. And this one is Chatterbox, which is, the premise is pretty simple. Ordinary girl in Hollywood who's very attractive suddenly finds out that her vagina talks and has a mind of its own. And that's kind of the whole film. It's got a whole bunch of people from the era, comedians, people like Rip Taylor's in it, and Erwin Corey, and a bunch of other people. And it's kind of one of those silly little 1970s sex comedies, which is always a lot of fun to watch. And the only other thing I'm going to mention that I watched was Knights of Badassdom, which stars Ryan Quanten and Peter Dinklage as a bunch of LARPers who summon up a demon and have to lay it to rest. Apparently this film had quite a troubled genesis, and it was made in 2011, wasn't released till 2013, something like that. And the film was kind of... This haunted cursor thing is getting to me here. Yeah, the film really did have some problems to it. And, the director said it wasn't his movie that got released. They re-edited the shit out of the studio did. But anyway, I picked it up really cheaply on Blu-ray and watched it. It's not too bad. It's got a lot of kind of in-jokes for geeks and fans. And I think it's a missed opportunity a little bit. It could have been a little more outrageous, a little more audacious, but it chose not to be. And that's it. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and then I'm going to get to my lists of stuff I've watched in 2014 formally and talk about some recommendations and things that I don't particularly recommend.
Blackula meets Slaughter. Now they're together for the first time on one big show. Blackula, the Black Avenger, more horrifying than Dracula. And Slaughter, it's not only his name. Slaughter is his business. See William Marshall as Blackula, Dracula's soul brother, a living corpse seeking to quench his hideous thirst for human blood. And Jim Brown as Slaughter. He had a rifle, a belly gun, four grenades, and a theory. The best defense is to attack. Slaughter and Blackula on one big show from American International Pictures. Blood-chilling adventure meets blood-curdling terror as Slaughter meets Blackula.
Okay, and I'm back. And what I'm going to do is go through the movies that I've seen in 2014 based on the assiduously careful letterboxing I did on letterboxd.com of every movie I watched. So I'm going to break it down into a few different categories because it's a non-trivial task to go through them all, so I'm not going to bother with that. I'm picking the eyes out of it. I'm picking the ones that for the most part, our first sees during the year. Not all, but most of them are the things I hadn't seen before, rather than rewatches, and things that I definitely recommend. So I'm going to start off with documentaries. And here is a clip compilation I created of the things I'm going to talk about in documentaries.
Blackula meets Slaughter. Now they're together for the first time on one big show. Blackula, the Black Avenger, more horrifying than Dracula, and Slaughter. It's not only his name, Slaughter is his business. See William Marshall as Blackula, Dracula's soul brother, a living corpse seeking to quench his hideous thirst for human blood. And Jim Brown as Slaughter. He had a rifle, a belly gun, four grenades, and a theory. The best defense is to attack. Slaughter and Blackula on one big show from American International Pictures. Blood-chilling adventure meets blood-curdling terror as Slaughter meets Blackula.
Our agent Marty Baum said, look, if you guys want to just go make a film and be totally left alone, there are two new guys in town.
Menachem Golden and Yoram Globus were the heavyweights. They were the George Foremans and the Muhammad Ali's of the indie market.
Canon is the only company who loves cinema. Cinema is our life.
Yoram Globus was the businessman behind the movie making.
Where is my money? You promise and promise and promise and you're not paying.
Menachem Golan was the movie maker.
Menachem, I cannot do it. I'm dying. He said, then I'll do it and then die.
I just had in my head what a movie producer should be, and Menachem just didn't quite fit that picture.
He redubbed me with an American voice, but not a voice that's similar to mine.
A true ninja doesn't kill, he eliminates, and only for defensive purposes.
He's so not ninja.
I don't know, I've never seen a ninja.
Fue tremenda. I wanted to make something sacred. Una película que diera las alucinaciones de LSD. Si tomara LSD to change the young mind of all the world. Michel Sidoux said to me, I want to make a new picture with you. What do you want to do? I say, Dune. And he said, yes.
C'était le plus beau livre de science-fiction. C'est la Bible de la science-fiction. Succès d'édition mondiale.
I didn't read Dune, but I have a friend who said it was fantastic.
Let's move on to a movie now that's one of the most brilliant, weird, and unusual American documentary films I've seen in a long time.
Roger Ebert was the definitive mainstream film critic in American cinema.
He has been writing for half of the history of feature films.
Roger was a mature writer early on.
He's written over a dozen books.
He wrote a novel.
He won a Pulitzer Prize.
How on earth did Roger Ebert write Beyond the Valley of the Dolls?
Boobs.
Beyond the Valley. You know, this is a title.
Roger was a good addition, but he also could take it.
He is a nice guy, but he's not that nice.
It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert in the Movies, and we've got three new ones.
Sound a little excited, Gene.
Sound less excited, Roger.
You can't really make a good movie without a great cinematographer. And I've had the good fortune of working with Donald McAlpine.
The magic is to take an audience to a place they haven't been, to excite an emotion they normally, in a day-to-day experience, don't have.
And that's what I love doing.
And action!
He's been the absolute heartbeat of cinematography in this country.
Nice of me mates call me Bazza.
Who could imagine what was going to happen in our lives?
It all sort of happened around me. Events just kept unfolding in front of me.
You could say that this turntable was the turning point in my career.
And I should add that these aren't in any particular order because I'm not going to rank them 1 to 5 or anything like that. comparing different movies is always problematic for me. It's either I like them and they've got this, this, and this to recommend them, or I don't like them and this, this, and this are the reasons why. So I'm not ranking things. I think that all of the things I'm going to talk about are worth watching, and all of them are worth your while. So the first one has got to be Deceptive Practice: The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay. Now, if you don't know who Ricky Jay is, check out the documentary, because he's superb. He's the best card artist in the world. He's a magician, basically. He does close-up card magic. He wrote a terrific book called Cards as Weapons, and he's been known to throw playing cards hard enough that they pierce watermelons. Now, Ricky's also a historian of magic, and really, he's been going since the 1970s, and he really is quite an interesting guy. He has a magnificent stage presence. He's not a pretty-looking guy. He's not an attractive-looking human being. He's not like one of the old classic magicians wearing a tuxedo and pulling cards from behind people's ears. He's a totally unique individual as far as that's concerned. And the documentary is great. It talks to a lot of people who know him, people like David Mamet, who directed one of Ricky Jay's TV documentaries and had been a friend of his for a very long time, and a lot of other people like that. But the best fun, of course, is just watching Ricky Jay with a deck of cards in his hand on a piece of green felt making magic happen. And the time taken in the artistry for this kind of stuff is magnificent. And just seeing somebody who is the best of the best at what they do is always a joy. The documentary is not particularly flashy. It doesn't draw attention to itself as a documentary. It draws attention to the subject matter, which is what you always want in a documentary. And it's a lot of fun to watch, and it makes you want to go and shuffle a deck of cards and see what you can do with them. And that's never a bad place to be. One of the things I do is I collect decks of cards. I've actually got an enormous box full of different card decks. And so I've got a lot of respect for people like Ricky Jay who can do that kind of thing. And I do know a couple of simple card tricks, which I do for people on occasion. Just enough to know exactly at how much higher a level somebody like Ricky Jay operates. So it's a hell of a documentary, and it's a lot of fun, and it kind of renews your faith in the ability of human beings to do marvelous things. And that's not a bad place to sit at the end of watching a film. Now, the second one is one that a lot of people in a lot of podcasts that we know and love have mentioned and enjoyed, and that, of course, is Jodorowsky's Dune, where Alejandro Jodorowsky, in the 1970s, around 1980, decided he was going to make an adaptation of Frank Herbert's novel Dune. And the pre-production went through, and it all fell into a heap, but Jodorowsky's vision for that movie and his visual stylings and the man's mind make this a really fascinating documentary. I often like documentaries about movies that fail and don't quite get made. There's been a number of them over the past. There's one about Terry Gilliam. There's another one about a couple of failed Orson Welles projects. And Orson Welles, of course, was going to play Baron Harkonnen in Jodorowsky's Dune as well. But this one is great. Visually, it's a lovely little documentary. It shows a lot of production drawings from Jodorowsky's big fat book of pre-production stuff that he sent around to various studios. And it's such a missed opportunity. And it just shows how pedestrian and ordinary the mind and imagination of people like George Lucas is. And how we've kind of got it dumbed down and kind of lessened science fiction cinema because of people like Lucas, and because people like Jodorowsky didn't get an opportunity to show us things that would blow our minds. So that's the second one. Pretty much all of these, except for the Ricky Jay one, are about movie making, which is kind of cool, or movies in some ways. But, of course, given I am who I am, that was always going to be happening, and it really was not a bad thing at all. The third one is Life Itself, the documentary about Roger Ebert and his life and career. It's a bit of a warts and all one. They don't kind of hide the fact that there were times when he was an asshole. they do also go into the problems you had with Gene Siskel when they were partnered up on television in America. I haven't seen a lot of the Siskel and Ebert stuff, so I'm kind of going secondhand on this. But it does show the passion for cinema that this guy had and the way that he lifted criticism of cinema to a whole new level by first off being a journalist and second off having that intense love of cinema. And, you know, that's the thing. It's easy to say this movie is shit. It's a little harder to say why it's shit, how it could have been better, what opportunities were missed, what opportunities in a crap movie were just pissed away. And in a good film, even the best of films, there are flaws in them. And pointing out the flaws in an almost perfect movie, people can often see as churlish. But I don't know, I see it as kind of a way of proving that it's the flaws that make things interesting sometimes. And even if you have got a magnificent film, there's always that one little bit that you kind of go, huh, about. And Ebert was a great person for pointing out those flaws without diminishing our appreciation of a piece of cinema. And that's one of the reasons I like him. He's probably my second favourite movie critic, my favourite being Pauline Kael, who I thought was magnificent, even though she was often off track. Just the academic rigour and the precision that she brought to movie reviewing is something that I've always been in awe of. But again, this is about movies, and I kind of like it for that, even though, of course, we all know the ending, and it's a sad ending. The next one is, I won't do that one, I'll do another one. There's an Australian documentary about Don McAlpine, who was a cinematographer. If you look up Don McAlpine on IMDb, and you'll see all the movies that he's worked on, and it's a mind-blowing amount of them. It's called Show Me the Magic, The Adventures of Don McAlpine, and it's a documentary done here in Australia. It wasn't done on a large budget. It was only shown on the ABC. But it has some footage of Don, who's almost kind of semi-retired now, and his wife as they cruise by caravan around Australia taking wildlife photographs and things like that. And they go back into the history of his work. He started out working for the ABC in rural New South Wales, filming, basically being a news cinematographer. And kind of worked his way up from that in the 1960s and came basically grassroots up into the top echelons of cinematographers in the world. And he's kind of eccentric but nice guy. And I like the way the documentary comes at him from the modern angle and then goes back into his past. It's not big budget. It doesn't have flashy special effects, but it is a good, honest look at somebody who, in his own ways, like Ricky Jay, is at the top of his game, or at least he was a couple of years ago at the time the documentary was made, and he enhanced the art form he worked in many, many ways. So that's called Show Me the Magic, The Adventures of Don McAlpine. Try to find it. There is a trailer for it on Vimeo, which might wet your whistle and just give you an idea of the movie itself. And the last one, of course, is Electric Boogaloo, The Wild and Untold Story of Canon Films, the great and interesting documentary. I have liked it on Facebook. Documentary about Canon Films and about Golan Globus, and just basically how they pissed away an opportunity to really be at the top end of things and to be Miramax before Miramax existed. It showed the kind of passion but the lack of precision that Canon Films brought to things. And it's one of those great movies where what you can do about it is sit down with a pen and paper as you watch the film and just write down names of things that you might have missed or that you want to revisit. And I kind of like that. It's a practice I started when I was looking at Martin Scorsese's documentaries about American film and Italian film, where you sit down with your pen and pad, and while you're watching it, you just madly scribble down the names of movies to watch. Never a bad thing. I'm really interested to see what Mark Hartley does next, because I think he's got a passion for this kind of stuff, and even though, from my point of view, and I'm willing to be disagree with on this, Electric Boogaloo is a lesser of the three films, not quite Hollywood, Machete Maidens Unleashed, and then this one. I still think that it's he's doing quirky documentaries. He's a beautiful visual stylist in documentaries as well. He does use some effects that enhance what he's doing in interesting ways. And also part of the fun of these films is the interviews he gets with cast and crew afterwards. It's always nice to see, oh, shit, that person looks old. No, they kind of look okay, this person. And just to get the stories they weren't willing to tell at the time, but they're now willing to tell about the 1980s as a crazy time in filmmaking, as indeed here in Australia the 1970s were in not quite Hollywood, and as the 1960s and 1970s were in Machete Maidens Unleashed. So Hartley, in that sense, is a documentary historian of film, but he doesn't like to do mainstream. He likes the kind of fringe and the cult and the weird stuff. Everybody makes documentaries about big movie studios. Mark Hartley's the man who's made a documentary about Canon Films, and that in itself is a lovely and glorious thing. So that's the documentaries, the five of them: Deceptive Practice, Jodorowsky's Dune, Life Itself, Show Me the Magic, and Electric Boogaloo. So I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, I'm going to look at the recent films that I've seen for the first time in 2014. I'm breaking out of the format for Paleo Cinema just a little bit this time around to talk about the top 10 interesting recent films that I saw in 2014.
This is Rudy Ray Moore, better known as Dolomite. I've got an all-girl army that knows what to do. They're boxers hell and practice kung fu. From the first to the last, I give them the blast so fast that their life is passed before they has even hit the grass.
Dolomite.
Uptown, downtown, crowned and renowned. I put my finger in the ground and turn the whole world around.
Dolomite.
Rated R. Under 17, not permitted without a parent or permission from your ward.
They say the world doesn't have heroes anymore? Well, damn them, Max. You and me, we're going to give them back their heroes. Hi there, this is Fifi from Mad Max, and you're listening to Paleo Cinema.
I know after your father I said I'd never ask you again. Don't let him hurt me.
Don't worry. I'll find him. And then we'll kill him.
Ryan Gosling is an odd actor. He started out as a child actor and all of the baggage that that entails, and now he's kind of got this career of doing tough guy acting in Drive, of course, and in the movie I'm about to talk about, which is Only God Forgives. What it feels like to me, and this is just purely a subjective impression, is that Ryan Gosling has studied tough guy actors of previous years, people like Steve McQueen and Lee Marvin and all of those kind of guys. And he's kind of built a persona around that kind of stillness, that lack of emotion that those guys turned into an enormous virtue. He's emulating, and it isn't emulation. It isn't anything genuine. It's very mannered acting in a minimalist kind of way, which I find interesting. But in this one, which is a story of Gosling as a criminal in Bangkok, his mother, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, who steals the movie away from him, only to then have the film stolen away from her by a Thai actor whose name is Vithaya Panjarigam. Yeah, that's right, yeah. And he is the breakaway star of this movie. He's a great physical actor. He's got an essential toughness to him. He's everything as an actor that Ryan Gosling wants to be but isn't. And I find that really interesting. I like the scenes with Vithaya in them more than I like the scenes with Ryan Gosling. And the singing karaoke, the sitting in a little noodle bar as a hit is put out on him, the practicing with the machete that he does in the early morning sunlight in Bangkok. He really does steal the movie away. And I like that. I mean, I like the fact that somebody who's not the big star of a film shows the big star how it's done and hands him his own ass. And this is very much what happens in Only God Forgives. And it's kind of an interesting approach to take. Nicholas Winding Refn's movies are always interesting and quirky. I don't know whether they're particularly good, but they're always interesting and quirky. And Only God Forgives is definitely one of those. I managed to pick it up for $8 secondhand at the one remaining movie rental place in around here. There's one down near the railway station at Hoppers Crossing. And I was looking through their Blu-rays for sale, secondhand ex-rentals. And that was there. So I picked it up because I like the movie and I like the style of it. I like the use of primary colors in it. I don't think it's a fantastic film, but I think it's a very individual film. And for that reason, I like it. Now, going on to the next one. The next movie I'm going to talk about is one I saw very early in the year. And that is Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, of course, died of an overdose in this year.
You're acting aggressive because you drank too much alcohol.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man, just like you.
Yeah, and it's got Amy Adams and Laura Dern, all those other people in it. And it's kind of a little bit of a Romana Clay film about Scientology and about L. Ron Hubbard, though they were very careful to skirt around that particular litigious pseudo-religion. Joaquin Phoenix is really good playing Freddie Quell, a sex-obsessed alcoholic World War II veteran. And he just basically carries the film, him and Hoffman going head-to-head in a kind of acting stoush. Is really interesting to see. And Phoenix does, one of the interesting things that Phoenix does, most of all, is he portrays a person. Let me step back a step. One of the problems that I have with a lot of movies that are set in the 1940s and 1950s with modern actors is they still feel like modern actors. They still feel like 21st century, second decade of the 21st century human beings. And one of the interesting things that Phoenix does in this, with the help, of course, of Paul Thomas Anderson, is he feels like a person from the 1940s and acts like a person from the 1940s. He kind of strips away 70 years of history and becomes a person of that time. And that's a really interesting process to watch and to realize in the film. Liz Travaskis and I talked about this one on ABC Local Radio in Darwin, and both of us found it a very kind of heavy-going film in the sense it's an emotional, a very kind of dark and heavy emotional journey. But we thought it was a great film as well. So really, Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, which again I've got on Blu-ray, I picked up cheaply on Blu-ray, is well worth checking out if you haven't already. And it is a fantastic film. Now, the next one, the third of the modern films I saw this year, which really kind of blew me away, was Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Part 1 and Part 2, starring Charlotte Gainsbourg and Stellan Skarsgård. These names are tripping me up at the moment. My tongue seems to be going numb. I did watch this in a marathon session, both 1 and 2, and it's a mind trip. It's transgressive. You can disagree with any amount of the film, its philosophy. I like the frame story around it and the way the frame story has its own arc and its own conclusion. And the story within that as well is kind of really heavy. And you end up being a voyeur in the life of this woman, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg as an older woman and played as a younger woman by Stacey Martin. And, I'm not sure I want to watch it again particularly, but I'm not unhappy that I watched it. I like movies that challenge me and that kind of challenge my belief systems as well. And that film definitely did so. It was a marathon session watching that. And really, even though, I mean, who would have thought you'd like a movie with Shia LaBeouf in it? But yeah, you do. And I'm conflicted about this film to a certain extent. But on the other hand, I'm glad I watched it, even though it's transgressive in a number of ways. I like films that challenge me, even when I come away from them thinking, why did you challenge me like that? I was comfortable where I was nice and complacent, and then suddenly this film comes along and starts fucking with my head. And I suppose all films do to a certain extent, but this one particularly. I wouldn't recommend it for people who are of a conservative nature, but if you do want to see some really outlier cinema, then Nymphomaniac's definitely the one to see. When it comes to movies based on comic books or graphic novels, at one end of the thing you've got the Marvel Cinematic Universe, of which I've spoken on podcasts at great, enormous length, in fact. And then you've got other ones which come at it from a different angle.
This is your world. The train saved humanity.
The engine lasts forever.
The population must always be kept in balance.
I said sit down!
Passengers, eternal order flows from the sacred engine. We must occupy our preordained position. I belong to the front. You belong to the tail. Know your place. Keep your place.
Those bastards in the front think they own us.
We'll be different when we get there.
What do you say?
We take the engine. And we control the world.
When is the time?
Soon.
And it is the 2013 Korean science fiction action film, Snowpiercer, directed by Bong Joon-ho, produced by Park Chan-wook. And starring Chris Evans, Song Kang-ho, Tilda Swinton, Jamie Bell, Ewan Bremner, John Hurt, and Ed Harris. And when I first heard the premise of this one, you know, like the survivors of an enormous ice age are all stuck on a train going around the world, and the poor people are at the back and the rich people are at the front and all that kind of thing, I thought, you know, this isn't going to work. It's going to be a piece of shit. But then I watched the movie, and it's the analogy it makes for the current condition of the world, particularly economically, is a strong one. And the upshot of the motive power for the train and what's actually going on at the front end of the train, even though it doesn't work as science fiction, it definitely works as cinema, and it definitely works as an analogy for our current economic system. Chris Evans is good in the film as well. He definitely steps out of Captain America effectively there. Tilda Swinton, you hate her guts in this film, even though everybody loves Tilda Swinton. Ed Harris and John Hurt are superb in the film as well. And even though there are times when the special effects can be slightly ropey, this movie does some interesting things. It's an action film with a point. And that point I'm not going to give away, because part of the learning what the point is the journey you go on when you're watching Snowpiercer. And this is definitely one of those films that is worth your time, and isn't, when you walk in the film, what you get isn't what you expect to get, but it's definitely satisfying, and it's definitely worth checking out. And that's why it's on the list of one of the top films that I've watched in this year. I think that the political points it makes are incredibly valid, and the way it demonstrates them without being preachy is very creative, and while being monstrous and tragic at the same time. And that's, I got more than I expected to get from this. I expected an action film, but I deliberately held off looking at any spoilers or looking at too many plot points towards the end of the film. And it is definitely a movie to get and keep. I'm going to revisit it sometime over the next couple of years. I'm not sure when. But Snowpiercer's earned its place on the list.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And so my life began.
junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustave H. Many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you.
She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
I approve of this union.
I became his pupil, and he was to be my counselor and guardian.
The police are here. Tell them I'll be right down.
The next one on the list is the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a lot of fun. Wes Anderson's stories and movie inspired by the writings of Stefan Zweig, starring, of course, Ralph Fiennes in a totally non-Voldemort role as Monsieur Gustave. Adrian Brody is in there, Willem Dafoe, Jeff Goldblum, Saoirse Ronan, Edward Norton, F. Murray Abraham, Matthew Almerich, Jude Law, Harvey Keitel, Bill Murray, Lea Seydoux, Jason Schwartzman, Tilda Swinton again, Tom Wilkinson, Owen Wilson, Bob Balaban. Great ensemble cast here, and a kind of gently hilarious movie. Very stylized in its visual look, but it's a hell of a lot of fun. In case you don't know about it, it's a recursive story about the goings-on in the Grand Boulevard. Boulevard? I'm thinking of Paris. But Grand Budapest Hotel in the Republic of Zabralka. And there's a recursive bit at the start about who's telling the story of whose story it actually is. And there's a kind of recursive frame story around this one, which is kind of interesting and does pay off at the end. And the story is about a young guy called Zero, who starts out as a lobby boy in the hotel under the tutelage of Monsieur Gustave, played by Ralph Fiennes. And the adventures they go on, he falls in love with a young girl played by Saoirse Ronan. And they, it's a kind of look at early 20th century Europe in a weird and quirky way. And there's not a mean bone in the body of this film. It is unashamedly nostalgic, but with a basis in realism, essentially. And I like it. It's one of those things that shows you that film can be all sorts of things, and it's almost kind of a realistic fairy tale in a weird sense. And it has so many great cameos in it that you can just sit back and enjoy this movie. It really, it's one of those movies that you can be jaded about watching films. You can see a lot of shit and a lot of shallow stuff. But then now and then you see a movie that's unashamedly joyous about being a film. And this is definitely one of those, and it's definitely one to revisit. I mean, I'm going to revisit it again, like Snowpiercer. It's one I'm going to come back to at some stage in the future. And when I need that kind of film, then films are often for us a prescription. Something may be happening. You have go-to movies when you're feeling down. You have go-to movies when you want to share something wonderful with friends or family. There's a prescription to watching certain kinds of film, and The Grand Budapest Hotel is definitely one of those films that can be a prescription for having the blues. It's just lovely and gentle and silly and funny and serious by turns, and really it, and visually striking, which is the other fantastic aspect to it as well. So that's definitely on the list to be recommended. The next one's actually an Australian film, which I'm going to highly recommend because it takes an old trope and uses local situations and local facts to tell a really solid story. In a sense, this film's a Western, but in another sense, it's a uniquely Australian film.
Why isn't this crime scene locked off?
I didn't think we'd worry about it out here, Jay. It's middle of nowhere.
Sam, we got a young girl. She's stabbed under the highway.
I know, Jay. Just see what you can come up with. Okay?
How's it going?
Are you a real cobber, are you?
one of them black trackers he turns on his own toy.
So what, you're just here for work? Not here to see your daughter?
You realize what you're doing in there? So much for your step, Jay boy. Big boots of yours will get you in trouble. Get you in trouble.
Said that you saw one of those dogs on the highway and it was carrying a human bone in its mouth.
Human bone.
And that is Ivan Sen's 2013 film Mystery Road, starring Aaron Pedersen, Hugo Weaving, Jack Thompson, Ryan Quanten and Tasma Walton. It's set in a real-life Australian town called Winton, and Detective Swan, played by Aaron Pedersen, who's Aboriginal, is taken, called out of the city to investigate the murder of a young Aboriginal girl. He finds her in a kind of tunnel underneath a road and gets involved a lot more deeply than he was planning to in the town he was born in. He's come back to the town after being a cop in the city. And he's kind of drawn back into the social problems with the Indigenous community and the white community in the town, and ends up finding out who the murderers are, and essentially, in one sense, not really solving the problems in the town. But this film is great. You can look at it as a Western. It does play well as a Western as well, but it does have that basis in an unfortunate reality of Australia at the moment. And it doesn't shy away from that. And Aaron Pedersen really does carry the film really well. He's one of our best Indigenous actors at the moment, and a fine Australian actor by any means. And the supporting cast, of course, with people like Hugo Weaving and Jack Thompson in it, is really superb. It's even got people like Bruce Spence in it, who people remember from the Mad Max movies, if nothing else. David Field, another great character actor. Roy Billing and Zoe Karides. If you haven't seen this one, I really highly recommend it. In a sense, I think it's a better film than The Rover, which I'm going to talk about in a moment. But, in fact, they make it a fantastic double feature, The Rover and Mystery Road. And there's a climax to the film, which involves gunplay, which is never a bad thing in the climax of a crime movie, which does things really interestingly and really differently and uses the landscape incredibly well for the purposes of an action piece. So Mystery Road, it's probably one of my top three or four if I was going to do a comparison. It was shown really briefly in a few Australian cinemas and then went directly to ABC television. But it has had a DVD and Blu-ray release here in Australia, so you should be able to buy it internationally if you've got an international Blu-ray player, or it may well turn up on Netflix or somewhere like that. Well, I hope it does, because I think it's a movie that deserves to have a wide distribution. And I'm looking forward to seeing what Ivan Sen does in future. So that brings us to The Rover. A lot of people have compared this movie to the first Mad Max movie. Of course, we've got Fury Road coming up, which has turned Mad Max into a spectacle with no real purpose. But anyway, this one stars Guy Pearce, Robert Pattinson, Scoot McNairy, David Field, and a bunch of other people. Filmed in South Australia, a part of the world that I'm very familiar with. And it's basically the story of a character called Eric, who, in an Australia 10 years after a global financial collapse, has his car stolen by a group of people played by David Field, Tawanda Manimo, and Scoot McNairy. And he wants to get his car back. The reasons why he wants to get his car back, we don't know till the end of the film. And they're really personal, in a sense. He finds, back at the town near where his car is stolen, Ray, who's been injured. He's the brother of one of the characters, the Scoot McNairy character, played by Robert Pattinson, who people remember from Twilight. And he basically takes Ray along with him to find out where they've gone with his car and to track them down. Now, I've got a few problems with the film. The main problem I've got really is that Robert Pattinson, I think, isn't particularly good in it, but the rest of it is. It's a rock solid action film, beautifully done, in the Flinders Ranges out near Corn. Yeah, I think Mystery Road I like a little bit better, but this one's still rock solid. It's a harsh and ugly world, but it's a world that there's enough similarities to parts of Australia that I know about now that it makes it very accessible. And it does create its universe very well. I'll give it that. It does create its universe very well. Like I said, Robert Pattinson's the problem I've got with this film. But it really does show an ugly end point for corporatization of the world and an internationalization of the world and a consideration that economic growth is an endless process and we can continue growing economies and everybody gets richer and richer and richer, which of course doesn't happen. That's the big fantasy of capitalism in a way. But it does portray a world that we haven't particularly seen in movies before. And while, again, this one could play as a Western, it could be done with horses and rather than cars to a big extent. I think that it does, it's definitely a movie worth checking out. And had I not seen Mystery Road about a week before I saw The Rover, I think I would have thought about this one a lot more highly. But it's rock solid in the fact that it's gritty and creates a realism that you don't sometimes see in films. It's got a protagonist who is very much an anti-hero, but not in the romantic sense. And it has a payoff. It was directed and written by David Michaud, along with Noel Edgerton. See what I did there? I got the Edgerton brothers' names mashed together. It was Joel Edgerton who wrote it, but Nash Edgerton, his brother, who appears in the movie. So I created a Noel Edgerton out of a composite of the two. But it does have a good payoff at the end, and really it shows the damage that certain systems of the world can create, and that in itself needs telling. So let me see what else I've got on the list there. Yep, I've got 1, 2, 3 more movies to do in the modern ones. Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this a two-parter. I probably won't get through all of the classic films I saw for the first time and enjoyed in 2014. So I'll add that as an extra to the next episode of Paleo Cinema Podcast, which will be the last of the year, and in which I have a guest. Our old friend Armin is back, and we're going to talk about strong female characters in classic films. But anyway, I'll get through the last three. The next one is a sequel, The Raid 2, which is the second of the Raid movies directed and written by Gareth Evans. It's a sequel, of course, to The Raid Redemption, and it's often known as The Raid 2 Berendal. Of course, it does have the same protagonist in it, Iko Uwais. And it's pure kinetic action cinema set in Indonesia, more specifically in Jakarta, and really does kick a lot of ass. It's just over the top. It has Iko Uwais as Rama, an undercover cop. Everybody else in it, of course, with a few exceptions, is really has unpronounceable Indonesian names, to be honest with you, except for Julia Stell playing Hammer Girl, one of the assassins whose weapon of choice is claw hammers. Now, I was actually, I got out my toolkit the other day, and part of my toolkit has a claw hammer in there. They're all kind of inset into a fold-out case, and the claw hammer, and it just occurred to me how great a claw hammer is as a weapon, because they're light, maneuverable, they pack a punch as well, and people get scared of them. The Hammer Girl is a really interesting character in this one, but it's got everything. It's got a terrific fight in the yard of a prison, which is turned into a mud pit by a tropical storm. It's got some great car chases. It's got high-rise fights in high-rise buildings. It's just basically pure kinetic cinema. It's one of those ones where you want to sit down with a few people and have a few drinks and just watch a pure action film. This is not a bad one to go to. It really does. I don't think it's quite as good or quite as wow as the first one of the two, but it's well worth checking out. And not just to be a completist, because it does show you parts of Indonesia that Australian tourists particularly don't see. Nobody goes to Jakarta when they go to Indonesia here from Australia. And a lot of people do. They go to Bali and go to the bars along Kuta Beach and things like that. In fact, my old friend, Ivor Cole, currently is living for a year or two in Indonesia, in Bali. He and his wife, Casey, have moved up there and rented a villa out in the countryside, away from the drunken tourists and the drugs and all the rest of it of the city, or the tourist strip in Bali. But they're up there at the moment having a lovely time. They go next door, they get breakfast for 70 cents, and they just seem to be chilling out. Ivor's back painting again. He's of course, he isn't doing the ABC radio as he had in the past, but he is back following his first love, which is painting. And it does seem to be having quite a lovely lifestyle up that way. But anyway, back to the action film. Raid 2 is definitely on my list because it's balls-to-the-walls action. It really does what it does incredibly well. And it does it in an environment that we don't often see in cinema that reaches Western countries. Now, the second last one I'm going to talk about is a much milder film and very much a kind of family-friendly almost movie about a world that once upon a time I was a minor part of, and that is Jon Favreau's Chef, which there's not too much to say about it. It's about a kind of high-profile chef who has a meltdown on social media and loses his job and kind of has to rebuild and starts up a food truck and cruises across America in his food truck with his young son over a summer and just basically redefines his life. It's a lighter film than a lot of the films I've talked about this time around in the podcast, but it's a very satisfying one. It makes you want to go out and get some food. It's one of those foodie films that really does get your salivary glands going. And while it is a kind of light and a small film, it does have a kind of Robert Downey Jr. in fact in it. While it is a kind of light souffle film, it's good-hearted, it's fun, and it's just for a change of pace. It's not a bad movie to watch. I definitely recommend that because, A, it's got food in it, which is never a bad thing, and it's got food well presented. B, it's got some nice actors surrounding Jon Favreau, people like John Leguizamo, as well as got that cameo, of course, by Robert Downey Jr., and by a bunch of other people. Oliver Platt's in there. It's just a nice little small film that Favreau made himself after having done the first two Iron Man films. Decided he wanted to do a slightly more personal and smaller budget film, going back to his roots, doing things like Swingers. And that's not a bad thing. It's just a good, honest little piece of entertainment and kind of welcome. I was going through a patch of seeing some very heavy films at that stage, and then I watched Chef, and I thought, yeah, this is what I need to cleanse my palate a little bit. The last one is David Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars with Julianne Moore and John Cusack, and a very good ensemble cast. It was written by Bruce Wagner, who wrote a very good novel about Hollywood about 25 years ago called Force Majeure, and who also wrote one of my favourite TV miniseries of all times, Wild Palms, which was very cyberpunk. It came out in the later 1980s. And very cyberpunky TV miniseries. But this one is really good. It's an evisceration of Hollywood. It's the first movie that Cronenberg made in California, and it shows. But it's really transgressive. It really, it's in the kind of in the same ballpark as classic Hollywood eviscerations like The Big Knife and The Bad and the Beautiful and things like that. It's an update of those things to a certain extent with a lot more realism chucked in. and the casting and the acting is really, really good. These people know these kinds of characters inside out, of course, being Hollywood actors. And there's a really nasty child actor in this film, which is always a nice thing to see. I'm not going to do too many spoilers on it, but definitely Maps to the Stars is a great film to watch. And if you're somebody like me who likes movies that are about movies, then this is definitely one to go for. It really does have a lot to say there. But having said that, I'm going to wrap it up here. And as I said, the movies, the older movies that I enjoyed in 2014, I'm going to put into the last podcast of the year. But anyway, I'm going to leave you with another reminder about the Patreon campaign. And you can still put in congratulations as well for the 150th episode, which this one is. And I'll put them all together for that extra episode I'm doing next time around. But anyway, in the meantime, if I don't talk to you before then, have a cool Newtonmas and a fine new year. Hope 2015 brings you everything you need and half the things you want. And I'll leave you with the credits, of course, at the end of the podcast in the style of the credits of a classic Hollywood film. But take care of yourselves, and I'll be back really, really soon. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.